Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Welcome. It is Monday, the 15th of May. We're halfway through this month. Wow. So we have a couple of public hearings and a work session, and then we're going to have an informational hearing getting an update on the Cleaner Air Oregon initiative. So let's just get started. I'm going to jump right in. David, which bill are you here to speak?
I'm not here. Oh. I was here actually for game meat, but now I'll stick around for Cleaner Air Oregon.
Okay, great. Thank Welcome. I'm going to open our public hearing on House Bill 2031A and ask Rep. Clem to come up. And And while he's doing that, Beth, can you tell us what this bill that includes the word Metolius is all about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2031A would extend the amount of time that a Metolius Resort site owner has to seek the approval of a small-scale recreational community, provided that the owner notify DLCD prior to June 30th, 2010. There is a fiscal statement that was issued, no revenue impact.
Okay. Brian, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Clem, and I represent District 21, which is right here where we're at now in Salem. And this bill, House Bill 2031, with a really wide relating clause, came over to you 52-4, dealing with the transferable development opportunities for the owner of the or owners of the Metolius Resort site. Some of you may recall 8 years ago now, we had quite a contentious session around the Metolius issue. I was the chief sponsor of the effort to limit the activities right around the Metolius River. The work since then has been to work with my former adversary on that issue, some of the resort site developers, to help them locate their project elsewhere, and we've unfortunately had difficulty finding the elsewhere, and so I've been back in front of the legislature, I think, three times, extending the deadlines and other things. I believe we finally have it this time. We got into a conversation last session where we discovered that Clatsop County was not on the list of sites that the transferable development opportunities could go to, and yet there's a site there that would make a lot of sense. It's called the Bradwood Landing site, and Clatsop County was really interested in doing something. So we added the word Clatsop in and extended the deadlines, thinking we'd be done. But then once we got into the actual discussions of the development site there, Clatsop noticed that there was a line that said, if it's in a area identified as subject to a natural hazard by an acknowledged comp plan provision, then it can't go there. Well, the problem is that site is in one of those. So this bill removes that provision. It does not get the applicants out of having to deal with Goal 7, which deals with mitigating natural hazards. It just gives them the shot to at least explain to the county's satisfaction how they would mitigate for being in like a floodplain, for example, whereas the way the bill was written, they couldn't even try. It also still requires a conditional use permit, so this isn't a carte blanche, you can build there. The county still has to approve of the project and put whatever sideboards they are. I've got some dash fours here that I have. I don't know if you have them. They came from Senator Johnson on the top, and I'm in support of these. What these do is narrow the bill from the House version from 5 years to complete these transferable development opportunities down to 3 years. The other thing it does, which is really helpful, all these years we've had a list referenced of high unemployment counties, but we actually didn't name the counties entirely in the bill. So the bill said Morrow County, Sherman County, Umatilla County, Clatsop County, Wheeler County, or a county that has this unemployment criteria. These dash fours just name all the counties and take out the whole list that's referenced, because people keep freaking out wondering whether their Deschutes County is on the list or whether Jefferson County is on the list, and they don't have the list of high unemployment counties to go to. So they always write me, you know, are you trying to get Deschutes back in here? So this once and for all would put the list of counties that the resorts could go to, and Deschutes nor Jefferson are not on this list. And that will, I think, help alleviate people who worry that we're trying to change something here. Since we passed it in 09, the only county that has been added is Clatsop, and that's the very likely intended location. The other thing we did in the House was place a condition that people should re-elect if they actually want to use these TDOs. There were three different property groups who could use them. We're not even, well, somebody's died in the meantime in one of the groups. I'm not even sure if anybody in the other groups want them anymore, but this says if you still want to use these within 30 days, notify DLCD. That way we'll narrow the universe down even further, potentially, of people who might actually go to try and build this project. And besides the wide relating clause, I would recommend your passage. It just depends what else you put into it, I guess, before I completely endorse it.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for your generosity, Rep. Planner. So,
where's those amendments?
Sorry.
We'll deal with those as they come.
Yeah.
In terms of the base bill, colleagues, any questions?
Yeah.
Senator Roblin?
Thank you. It's only been 8 years. You've only had to do this three times. So 15 years from now, when you come back for the next one, I'm concerned that if you list the counties, other counties might have gotten poor, others might have gotten richer, and you may not want the same list. So are you sure you want to list the counties?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, the counties were functionally listed already anyway, because it was a list as of the date in 2009. It's just no one knew what that meant, so then we always had to call an agency and have them reproduce a list every time. And luckily, it's come back consistent, but if it had ever changed by one, that's people would be angry about that, too.
Okay, so it was based on the time that the bill was done. Okay.
It was the 10 years prior to 2009, and who had the highest unemployment over a long period of time prior to the passage of the Metolius bill. And just for a little bit of historical record, the LCDC, when they recommended the Metolius as an statewide area of critical concern, they spoke to these transferable development opportunities and said these resort site owners either should get to build a certain number of units at the resort site, or if the legislature gives them a chance to go elsewhere. And that was part of their condition of recommending it. And so we did the, instead of building 35 there at the location, we said you can build up to 300 and some elsewhere. So it's a much larger project, but it also was designed to help them be able to prove their model that you can build resorts that aren't all about golf courses and first homes. And for the resort developers, having it within driving distance of the Portland market should help be able to make it successful in ways that further out are more challenging because of the driving distance for like weekend type people to go to a resort.
And just to clarify, you're okay with 3 years as opposed to 5 years?
Yeah, and I've spoke with the developer, and of course, would prefer no sunset at all just to make sure the project happens, but I think they're totally fine and should be doable within 3 years.
And is your sense that in 3 years, if we don't have a project, they will go away? Or
I would say so, actually. We've talked about this a lot, and he's even said, you know, should we keep doing this? And I said, one more time, we believe we have a site. It's just the wording of the last several iterations didn't envision this natural hazard, mitigatable natural hazard site at Bradwood Landing. But I drove out there and took a look at it. It was a subject of a big debate about LNG. I think most people would much rather it's an eco-friendly resort than an LNG site. So I think we will get support. But Clatsop County would still have to approve this at their level and deal with any objections at that level or any other county.
Senator Roblin.
I just want to say I really love the idea of the kind of resort they were going to build. So I would love to see it get started and actually be successful. That would be nice from my perspective. And this way, if it doesn't work out, we'll get to see them sooner than, you know, it had to be. More repeated than less.
Mr. Chair, as Senator Roblin indicated, there were many people who were excited about the resort site idea. They were just a little bit nervous about its proximity to the Metolius, and I can promise you there was a 16th and 31 vote that absolutely demanded that they get their chance to build somewhere else, which is why I'm still working on this 8 years later, because I promised a now-sitting congresswoman, and I forgot what community college Representative Galizio is now off at, but both of them said, before I vote for it, I want to make sure these people get to try their idea, and that's why I've stuck with it so long. It wouldn't have passed without some assurance they could try their idea.
California Association of Community Colleges.
Yeah, cool. That's where he is.
Yeah. The whole thing.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Brian.
Okay.
It's a statement.
Okay. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that the site that they're looking at is formerly was being considered for the LNG. You just can see the opportunities that are there that someone might think it could be only for one thing, and now we're seeing it potentially going to be used for something that may be a little bit more receptive to the community.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. Okay, we have Bob Bailey. I assume that you want to speak about the base bill, right? Is there anybody else who wants to speak about the base bill? Okay, why don't you come up, Bob?
Thank you very much. Okay. For the record, Robert Bailey, representing Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition. We've been engaged in many a land use battle along the coast to preserve and protect coastal shorelands and beaches from inappropriate and sometimes dumb development. We have some major concerns about the bill, principally centered around the message that it sends about Goal 17, coastal shorelands, and developing in areas of natural hazard. I'm a little bit reassured by Representative Clem's discussion here, but I think it needs to be very clear that neither of the provisions that are in this bill do not exempt the developer from the coastal shorelands provisions, Goal 17, which are there for a reason, nor the natural hazards requirements under Goal 7. We live in a dynamic state, and shorelands are one of the places where developers love to build for a lot of reasons, because they're beautiful, they're aesthetically pleasing, but they're also physically challenging, and sometimes the people that end up buying there are not aware of those hazards until they buy, and suddenly they're stuck with a situation where flooding or landslides, this and that and the other thing. So we're very concerned that you be very clear in this that the exemption for coastal shorelands and hazards does not undermine those two goals by parachuting a development in where it otherwise wouldn't be. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. I think my understanding is that what this bill will do is put Clatsop in the same category as, well, I guess, Lincoln County's on the list and Curry County, where if it were to be located in those areas, they would still have to meet those criteria.
Good. It wasn't clear from reading the bill, Mr. Chairman, at the beginning that was actually the case. So,
is that? Yes. Great. Okay. Any questions for Bob?
No.
Okay.
Thank you so much
for coming. Yeah. Okay. I have Amanda Rich here, and I assume you want to speak to one of the amendments. Do we have anybody else who wants to speak to any potential amendment?
Or a whole new bill, for that matter.
Yeah.
Oh, it was
you know, really, you're all wild. This bill has a really wide relating clause. This is your opportunity to come up.
Relating to use of land, boy.
Do you have anything for
yeah, it's pretty wide.
Use of land. Land could be used for many things.
Exactly.
Mr. Honeycutt's back there. I assume he has a couple of options that he has.
Okay, Amanda, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm with State Street Solutions, and I'm here today representing Old Castle Materials. I do have a proposed amendment that is on OLIS. It is the dash A3, and it is not case specific. It is not dispositive in any particular application or situation that's going on right now, but it does arise out of a particular situation, which I'll briefly describe to you. I'm passing out a timeline, which will hopefully a few copies will get back to the back of the room, but we've got a situation, and we can just have it be a hypothetical county where applications have been filed that are all in one lump, a comp plan amendment, zoning change, and a few permits, floodplain permit and a conditional use permit. And these have been traveling together through three approvals by the county and through three appeals to LUBA and three remands for 16 years. And here we are today. And the LUBA has remanded to the county, as I said, for the third time. And that decision has not been appealed. And at this point, no action has been taken by the county on remand. And in looking at this situation, I know that this is somewhat anomalous, but it is not unheard of for folks who are facing a highly politicized situation or a highly technical situation regarding a land use application, particularly one that stretches out over a long period of time, to get into a ping-ponging back and forth and, frankly, get into a situation where you have a county commission that has become difficult for them to hold public hearings, and not only because they are long, they are technical, they are emotional, and they are difficult to hold within the scope of remand every time it comes back with a specific set of decision-making criteria. It just has become is become difficult to hold these hearings in front of the county commission. So what this amendment would do is give any county authority under an existing statute, ORS 215-431, that currently allows a delegation of public hearing responsibility to a planning commission or a hearings officer for most decisions, with the exception of, pardon me, for most plan amendment subjects, with the exception of agricultural land and forest land. What this amendment would do is allow for that delegation to occur, but only to occur upon remand. So this would be after a set of applications or an application for a plan amendment has been through a full cycle with the county and has been appealed and has come back down on remand. At that point, if the county decides that it is in the best interest of the parties and the best interest of the county to have this decision, both the hearings process and the decision, delegated to a public hearings officer or to their planning commission, they may decide to do so. It is not required. It is upon their own decision, and because it has been through a full cycle, will be based on a full set of information that they've received in a previous public hearing. And then that decision would then be appealable to LUBA. So essentially is shifting your decision-making loop upon remand in a case like this. If the county chooses to afford themselves this opportunity, you shift your decision-making loop to between public hearings officer or planning commission, whichever delegee the county chooses, and between LUBA. So as you can see, it's not dispositive in any case. It just allows the county to delegate that, shift that decision to a different loop, and allow the case to play out outside of certain factors. That, with the exception of also adding an emergency clause, is the whole of the amendment. And the reasoning really is that it shouldn't take 16 years to get a decision. these cases are very difficult. They are very emotional, and they're involving people's livelihoods, lives, and quality of life and type of life, frankly, on both sides in some cases. So for that reason, they should be given due amount of attention. But for that reason, we also should figure out a way to get them to conclusion in a thorough but somewhat more timely fashion than a 16-year wait for a decision, frankly, whichever decision it might be. And I would urge your support, please, for the Dash 3 Amendment, and am open to any questions you may have.
Great. So I do have a question. You know, I understand the desire to avoid it having to go to the commission time and again. And I understand the concern about just the length of time that this has taken. But if you were to free the county commission from being involved again, I mean, how much of the delay is that responsible for? Is that really going to speed things up?
Chair Dembrough, thank you for the question. And in fact, in some cases, it actually could speed things up considerably. Some cases, and this would be the more unusual type of case, but again, not unheard of. These things become election issues, and they become pretty much hot potatoes. And so some of the long delays that you see in that timeline, where you see a 4-year wait until a decision gets taken, or remand proceedings occur, or a 3-year wait, or that frequently is because of the political nature. Our statutes do not allow a mandamus on a comp plan amendment, because that is a legislative decision by the county. In this case, we are saying, great, they can make the legislative decision that first time, and once that is made, then further refinement of said decision upon remand could occur in that side decision-making loop. So to directly answer your question, I believe in some cases it could shorten the time considerably.
Colleagues, any questions for Amanda about this? Floyd? I'm sorry, Senator Brzozinski.
That's fine. So Amanda, going through that, I got the loop, understand that, and I understand it being hot potato, but I mean, it is the elected officials' obligation to be doing this. They're asking us to take them out from that pressure point, but it also seems like you put it in some other decision thing, it's done, then it goes back up potentially, then it comes back down, mm-hmm. and then where does it go? I mean, I just...
Chair Dembrough, Senator Brzozinski, thank you for the question. This is not a perfect solution to this issue. I'm not sure there is any perfect solution, and you've pointed out that obviously you could be on a different, let's call it a Ferris wheel, where they don't quite let you off when the ride ends and you go back up to the top and come back down. But in this case, the hope is that number one, things will go a little faster, so you won't have changes in other statutes that feed into this decision that then complicate factors and stretch time out further. And you might be able to possibly get a decision without having multiple changes in landowner ownership over time. And that you could, with delegation to, and again, this is a delegation that is an option only, but with delegation to a public hearings officer who is not as beholden to the community for votes and support, they may be more able to say to folks, you know, we really need to stay within the scope in this hearing. And we, you know, the decision we have been asked to make is in this line of discussion. And I understand that you have concerns over here, but that is now outside of our scope. And I think that it's really hard for county commissioners sometimes to do that. Some do it incredibly well. Others find it difficult. But they are brilliant generalists. They are not always jurists, if I may.
I hear that point. I think a lot probably depends on what LUBA is directing them to do, you know, when it gets sent back. If it's something very technical, then, you know, then it probably makes sense to have a hearing officer do it. But if it's something more substantive, you know, like, you know, as you have in your example, to adopt economic, social, environmental, and energy consequence analysis and modify conditions, that could get political, I mean, if I'm going to use that word, and it really is probably more appropriate that the commission deal with that.
Chair Denbrough, I absolutely, and that is why this is an optional delegation. It maintains that local control factor where the county can decide, well, what is it that we're being asked to review here upon remand? Do we feel like it is appropriate for our process to delegate the decision, or should it be kept at the commission level because it is more in a legislative nature?
Okay, any other questions? No. Okay, thanks, Mayor.
Thank you. I very much appreciate the time.
Yeah. Okay, is there anyone else who wanted to speak to this bill again? So we will probably be posting this for a work session, and we will consider all the amendments that might come in between now and then. With that, I will close our public hearing on House Bill 2031 and open our public hearing on House Bill 2321. And Scott, you want to come up for that? And Beth, while he's doing that, could you tell us what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2321A would require boaters to remove or open all devices used to control draining of water from the boat before transporting the boat within the state. And it would also require someone who's transporting a boat to return to a bypassed inspection station if stopped by a peace officer, provided the station's open and within 5 miles of the location of the stop. Minimal fiscal impact, no revenue.
Thank you. Welcome, good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. I do have a PowerPoint to go through. I provided written testimony, but I want to go through that PowerPoint quickly. Just a couple of slides I'll go through real quickly because ODF&W is also here, and we'll cover them in more detail because that's more within their area of responsibility, but to give you an idea of what this bill does. So a little bit of legislative background. The Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program came into being in 2009 through House Bill 2220 and House Bill 2583. And then in 2011, we established the mandatory inspection stations under House Bill 3399. I'm going to go through this one. So a little bit about our stations. Like I said, Rick Boatner from ODF&W talked a little bit about the stations, but I wanted to provide a little bit of information about how we're doing. So in 2016, we inspected 16,825 watercraft. You can see the numbers go up year by year. We're able to open the stations a little bit longer to have more boats come through. And so we've improved the number of folks that are stopping at the station, so there's not as many drive-bys as well. Contamination data, as you can see, that's increased over the years with quagga and zebra mussels remaining right in that 15 to 18 range, but it is going up slightly. So in most recently, 294 were stopped with contaminated aquatic vegetation, 51 with marine organisms, 11 with freshwater organisms, and 18 with other biofoulings. The remaining 17 watercraft were contaminated with quagga or zebra mussels originating from Arizona, California, Indiana, Nevada, and Oklahoma. You can see by our boat inspection data, this gives you a picture. As I said, compliance has increased right now. Based on 2016 data, we have about 82% compliance of those stopping at inspection stations. So this is the first mussel boat that has been stopped this season. This boat came out of Tennessee and had zebra mussels on board. Actually one zebra mussel, but a lot of other indications of fouling, and that was cleaned at the Ontario station. So House Bill 2321, the engrossed bill, here's what it does. There's three things that it accomplishes. The first, the bill requires boaters to open all drain plugs, bailers, valves, or other devices used to control the draining of water from ballast tanks, bilges, live wells, and motor wells. Boats must be transported within the state in this manner. The penalty for failure to comply is a Class D violation. Presumptive fines for Class D violations are normally $110. However, the intent of the bill is not to penalize boaters, but to encourage compliance, so a presumptive fine of $30 for non-motorized boats and $50 for motorized boats is proposed as an alternative to the normal fine. The bill does provide an exemption for boats operated by law enforcement and emergency responders, since in many cases these boats have to launch during an emergency, and failure to reinsert the drain plug could be a significant safety issue and prolong the response time. Secondly, the bill gives law enforcement the authority to require a vehicle transporting a boat that bypasses an open inspection station to return to the station. A current statute does not provide law enforcement authority to require a vehicle transporting a boat that bypasses an open inspection station to return for inspection. Law enforcement officers are not trained to conduct the inspections, and the law does not allow them to conduct the inspections. Therefore, the only option are for drivers to voluntarily return or continue driving with no inspection. This increases the potential for a mussel-fouled boat to be allowed into the state and potentially contaminate waterways. The bill also requires a person transporting a boat to return to an inspection station if stopped by law enforcement for bypassing a mandatory inspection station, provided the station is open and within 5 miles of the stop. Failure to return, if directed by law enforcement, is a Class C misdemeanor. Third, the bill requires drivers to cooperate if an inspector recommends decontamination. So that's what the A engrossed bill accomplishes. We are also supportive of the -A5 amendment as well. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions for Scott? Scott, so someone coming into Oregon from another state has to have a permit to deploy their boat in Oregon, or is the permit, just for residents of Oregon?
So, Chair Dembro, yes. Everyone using a boat in Oregon, if they are 10 feet and longer for non-motorized or any motorized boat, is required to have a permit.
Okay. And we'll have someone else explaining the state, the inspection stations, and can give us more details about those.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Rick Boatner from ODF&W does have a presentation to talk a little bit about the station, so I figured since he's the expert, I would let him cover
that. We'll hold off. Okay. Yes, Senator Roper.
And we do have mussels now in Montana for the first time in, I think, three water bodies, which most people believe this is how they get here. We only operated ours during the daylight hours, so we do know boats are coming through, which makes me really nervous as I see the 17 and 18 boats that are making it through now with quagga zebras on them, and it only takes one. So I appreciate what we're doing. I think the fact that if they passed and it was open, you should send them back is a good bill. On I-5, is there a turnaround within 5 miles of the, if you're on I-5? The checkout station?
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, that is correct. There is a turnaround on I-5, yes.
Okay. Then I'm good.
Great. Yeah. So before you leave, Scott, Vice Chair Olson couldn't be here today, but he has proposed some amendments that would extend the permit requirement to a much broader class of boats, I think, to all other than beach-type boats. You want to speak to that?
Yeah. Chair Dembro, members of the committee. So there's parts of the amendment that didn't come from the Marine Board, so ODF&W would probably be better off talking about those. We did have a discussion with Senator Olson and mentioned that the engrossed bill out of the House did remove what we had originally asked for. Well, what we asked for was to remove the exemption for boats under 10 feet in the original bill. The purpose for that is twofold. One, we're going to have to cut about $473,000 out of current service level budget in the Aquatic Invasive Species Program. The other piece to that is the 10-foot number is an arbitrary number that came into being when the law was passed in 2009. It doesn't separate any type of usage or any type of boater. There's a number of very similar boats that are 9 foot 9 inches that are quite the same as those that are 10 foot 3 inches. And law enforcement has a difficult time telling which is which. Just because it might say a certain size doesn't mean it actually equates to that length. So rather than looking at an increase in the fee for the permit, we looked at eliminating that 10-foot exemption in the original bill, and that's what the A5 amendment does as well.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, and Scott and I have already had this conversation. I know it's an arbitrary number, but I also said 12 feet. It could be a number two. I understand people want to go down, but then you're getting into family activity, that if you're going to have it for every boat that a family takes out there, if you've got four or five boats out there, how much is that costing that family to go out and have a day out on the water?
Chair Dembro, Senator Brzezinski, I would also point out the amendment also establishes that it's only for those that are older than 13 years old. The permit doesn't apply for 13 years and younger to try to deal with the families that are going out in the boats.
Yeah, if I can follow up, I saw that it was 14 had been taken out. I hadn't seen it. I see that it's now says 13 and under. But I still think that's an issue of question that I would raise as to pricing people off the water.
Right. We'll be talking about amendments
yeah.
before the work session happens. Okay, so. Okay, thanks a lot,
Scott.
Thank you. Okay, let's have Rick Boatner and Shannon Hearn.
Good morning, Chair, or good afternoon, I guess, this year, Dembro and Senate Committee. I'm Rick Boatner with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm the invasive species coordinator for the agency and also manage the boat inspection program for the state. Today, I'd like to just give you a quick update of our program and what we're doing. I want to go over what we did in 2016 and show you kind of what we find in the check station and what we're planning for this 2017 season. The Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program, one of our goals is to protect Oregon waters from the introduction or spread of invasive species, and that is one of our key elements in our agency's conservation strategy plan. The other one, and it's a big component, is we want to educate everyone about aquatic invasive species. Wanted to make it a dinner time conversation if we can. Scott had a similar slide. This is in 2016. This is where we had watercraft coming from in 49 states, a few provinces, Mexico. And you see the, yeah, comes the pink. Those are states that are currently have quagga or zebra mussels in them at this time. You can see just a few of us left that are free of quagga zebra mussels. In 2016, we did a little shy of 17,000 inspections. And Ontario and Central Point are our busiest stations. The Ontario station did just shy over 6,000 inspections. And the 260, that's total for all biofiling. That's just not quagga and zebra mussels. We look for other things like Eurasian milfoil, hydrilla, false Conrad mussels, live fish. So we're looking for more than just quagga and zebra mussels. Central Point is generally our busiest one. That's on I-5, just a little over 7,000. And they intercepted 81 vessels with biofiling. The others are slightly slower. Gold Beach is a busier one. The interesting, our slowest one is Lakeview. And that actually caught a quagga and zebra mussel boat last year. And that's the second time in the program they've caught one on that outside of Lakeview.
Chair, I'm just looking at where the inspection stations are at. And the first thing that just popped out, there's nothing around the Portland area. So
correct.
People coming from the north on I-5, their first opportunity would be Salem. And that just seems like a pretty large potential point of entry where people not intentionally diverting around Salem, but clearly can come into the state and, I mean, they could even go right.
They go on 84, go
right.
East.
Yeah.
Well, the Salem is more, we get calls from other states like California. If something comes through a check station, they'll notify us for some reason they couldn't decon and inspect it. Then we actually call the individual up and arrange to have an inspection at their house and decon their vessels. That's where the Salem comes in. Portland's very difficult off of I-5. There's no really good spot to stop anybody before they can split off. And if you even look up towards that story, I don't have a clue how we do with the Bowie 10 fisheries.
Exactly.
Fortunately, Washington's not infested, so we're a little protected from that side.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, so from my perspective, with quagga and zebras, at least Idaho is checking at their border stations. Montana's checking. Now they're even checking more hardly. Mm-hmm. Washington checks. British Columbia checks. Alberta checks. Saskatchewan is thinking about it. I don't know if they're already doing it.
Yes.
So we have a big network that we're surrounded by that are already checking boats. So it's if they got through them, they're probably okay. The only ones that are coming is our ocean aquatics, which we don't have much check. We don't do a lot of checking for those ships, which is frustrating. And you'll find in bays like Coos Bay and others, we have a lot of critters we wish we didn't have. But when it comes to freshwater critters, we're protected a little bit by our states around us that are doing the same kinds of things and working at it. So,
Chair Dimbros and Roblin, that's correct. We do have, in the Pacific Northwest, perimeter defense. So we have a program, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, Arizona. Now all have programs. Washington's really starting up their program this year. They've had some roving inspections over the years. And then, of course, Montana has really developed their program this year due to the recent case of quagga mussels in Tabor Reservoir. So this is what we intercepted last year. We intercepted 17 boats with quagga and zebra mussels on them. 10 of them were from Lake Mead, Lake Pleasant, Lake Havasu, the lower Colorado River system, Lake Chapman in Indiana, and one out of Oklahoma. And as you can see, Ontario catches most of our boats. They get to Lake Powell, Great Lakes, Lake Mead boats generally. Central Point, the same. They get more Lake Mead and Lake Havasu and Lake Pleasant boats coming through there. Like I said, Lakeview, second time since our program started, it has intercepted a boat on that little pullout there. So this is good.
How about Salem, too?
Salem, like I said, we get phone calls.
Okay.
And that's how, you know, we have one a great network among the coordinators. So we call each other if a boat's coming through, and that for some reason they can't decon it, especially like Idaho. They have some rules in their commercial that on a commercial haul, if the guy says to stop, they have to stop and let it go. So Idaho will call us and tell us it's coming through, and we call them and make sure we get an inspection and finish the decon if necessary. California does, so does Arizona, and now Lake Mead has started to call us and let us know when boats are coming through. And those are the ones we go to their address and do the inspection and the decon there if they happen to go past one of our check stations.
Yes, go ahead.
During the big drought, there were a lot of houseboats moving out of some of these California lakes. Did we check those pretty well? Do you know? Because they were commercially being hauled out and moved.
Senator Dembro, Senator Roblin, yeah, we checked quite a few of them. If we were open, they were checked. If not, if we got calls, then we'd call them up and do an inspection. And if they were going to Washington, the person would actually get called for Oregon. We'd call them, and Washington would call them. So we made sure we could get through to get to them. This is some of the things we've seen. It's all types of boats. We even get kayaks. The kayaks down there were hot wash for New Zealand mud snails. The others were quagga and zebra mussels. So we get commercial haulers, which are 56, 44 footers, pretty good size, as well as smaller, you know, 15 and 20 foot boats that come through. Pontoon boats are real common, and they're one of the more headaches to deal with. There's more little hidey holes for these things to hide in. Saw this map. This is the July map of where quagga and zebra mussels are located. And we were still clear in the northwest. And as Scott mentioned, until Montana got infested with Tabor Reservoir and Ferry Canyon Reservoir. So this year, in 2017, we already got our check stations up and running. We opened Central Point earlier and Ontario earlier because we were noticing a lot of commercial traffic coming through at an earlier time. Lakeview will be open next week, so we'll have the five check stations open here within the next week or so. We're also proposing to set up a check station in Umatilla due to Montana incident, so we can catch those boats. And also here in outside of Bern, so we can catch boats coming out of Nevada, out of Wild Horse Reservoir, and those which had a positive check for quagga and zebra mussels. Mind the drain plug, other things. We generally talk about quagga and zebra mussels, the villagers, but in standing water, there's other critters that come along. We have the spiny water flea, which was infested Colorado now that came out of the Great Lakes. And we're also concerned about diseases coming in. VHS is one that's viral hemorrhagic septicemia. Basically, the fish bleeds out, and that's out of the Great Lakes. So we're concerned about disease and other critters coming in standing water. So the drain plug being pulled will be a great asset to that, to our toolbox. That'll take any questions.
Yeah, do we have cleaning stations that are moving around to our lakes that are not at these, at our checkpoints? Have we had I was hoping Colorado and California would have them at every one of their lakes, but.
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, there's a few places like Diamond Lake has a cleaning station. They're actually putting two interns at their boat ramps. We do have, and the Marine Board has a cleaning station at down by Coos Bay, and I'm drawing a blank, sorry, on the lake down there. But pretty much where have they the cleaning, the decon units around the state. And one of those I prefer, our team is trained how to do them, and most of them just call us, and then we go out and do it.
Great. Have we ever looked at the, Montana have some dogs that got trained to sniff quagga and zebras. Have we ever had them spend some time with us? Because they could actually, I know they tried them up in Alberta at night. They could find quagga and zebras. Have we ever had those teams come around our...
Senator Robo, no, we have not had those teams. Alberta has a team, and California does.
Yeah.
And Montana borrowed the Alberta team to do the Tabor Reservoir. It's quite expensive for the training and the upkeep, but that would be something to look at in the future.
Pretty amazing.
They're got very sensitive, and especially, like, I can see it working like a buoy tin where you got a lot of boats lined up. They could go through it rather quickly.
Shannon, let's hear from you, and then I have some questions.
Okay. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director at Department of Fish and Wildlife. First, I want to thank you for hearing this today. We didn't have a lot of time for conversation about this on the House side. In particular, was that removal of the exemption for under 10 feet. We submitted written testimony. You'll see in our written testimony, we threw out the number 7 feet, maybe 12, 10, trying to find that number that we could live with. But certainly we know there is a large contingency of boats out there that we are not getting, that 6 foot to 9.5 plus range. And having been a fish biologist in Southeast Oregon in the desert for a long time, those are the most heavily transported boats in those areas. And as we see places like Nevada and these smaller reservoirs turn up with invasives, this is likely where they're going to come from, in particular from those types of places. I think we have a good handle on the bigger boats and the larger reservoirs, but these smaller ones pose just as much a risk. So we'd like to have that conversation. The other conversation that we've had recently is we missed in the House side that we needed an exemption in order to do our work, specifically where we have to drain live wells before we leave the water body. We think we'd be able to cover that with our fish transport permit program if you were exempted under that. And so you'll see an amendment for that.
Great. So in terms of how the permit is enforced currently, is it just when one is called into an inspection station, or is the permit being requested at other times? I'm trying to imagine, as you know, if we do roll it out to the smaller boats, there's going to have to be some education for people to, you know, I think most people would have no idea that they would need a permit.
Yeah.
Senator Dembrough, currently for inspection purposes, all watercraft have to be inspected. For permit purposes, only boats that are going on the water, and we do not check them at the inspection stations. Law enforcement will check them if they're on the water when they're doing fishing license and other things like in those nature.
Mm-hmm. Senator Batchelor.
A couple questions. First one, what's the hours of operation on these checkpoints?
Senator Dembrough, Senator, it varies between check stations. Central Point in Ontario, we generally, this time of year, running 12 hours a day, pretty much 7 to 7, because we have four-man crews. At the Gold Beach, Klamath Falls, and Lakeview, we run 5/8, so we vary the hours. Sometimes it's 8 to 5, sometimes I start them at 6 in the morning, and sometimes at 1 o'clock to work tonight, so we kind of vary that.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. And this permit it's included in your boat license now, correct?
For your registered boats, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm done.
Okay. Senator Robla?
No, the permits, can you transfer it from one boat to the other if you're only using one boat and you have one permit?
Senator Roebling, yes, they're transferable, which makes us a little different than other states like Idaho around us. People like that option when we rolled it out way back in 2000.
So if you have a family, you could have 2 or 3 boats. You decide if you have 2 permits and you didn't want to take all 3, the 2 permits will work for you.
Yes, just as long as you have 1 permit for each boat on the water, unless the kid is 13 or younger.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to call on Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, so on the inspections, my understanding is as boats are being transported, and let's say it's an inflatable boat, the only time they have to stop for inspection is when it's inflated and at currently 10 feet or longer, correct?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Brzezinski, we tried to clarify that in our testimony because I keep messing it up as well.
Right.
If it's a watercraft defined as a boat and it's visible, yes, you are required to stop. Technically, even if it's deflated and in your truck, you're required to stop. However, we can't enforce that because we don't know that boat is deflated and in that motor vehicle.
So if someone would just happen to be going on a rafting trip, let's say to the state of Colorado or Arizona, and they have X number of boats that are in their trailers that are, let's say, packed underneath a lot of stuff.
You'll
are we saying
it.
That we're going to have them remove the boats and either lay them out or have them inflated to inspect them?
Well, currently it seems as if many of them are covered by existing law.
Only if they come back. We don't care when they're going.
Yeah.
Incoming, not outgoing.
For the most part, on those boats, if they do come into inspection stations, we will inspect them. We'll use it as more of an education opportunity. Most of them, they're folded up, just will go on. And so we'll never know because we can't visibly see them.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Roble.
Are we getting any closer to understanding what we can do with wake boats and their ballasts?
Senator Dimbro, Senator Roblin, actually the manufacturing companies are coming alongside very well. They're developing a new filter system for them. If it comes from a infested water body, we will still hot flush that ballast tank to make sure there's no standing water there because we can't see it. But like I said, the industry is making a lot of improvements to make it easier for the states inspecting boats. So they've come alongside very nicely.
Good to hear.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both very much for coming here and for the work that you do.
Great.
It's very important. And we will consider the amendments, maybe changing the length of the boats. We'll do some cogitation over that.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. And I just have Peggy Lynch. Wait, Bob's here. Peggy, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. So the first thing is all of the bills that you saw related to aquatic invasive species are bills that the League has supported over the years. And the reason is if we get those invasives, it is hugely expensive for our public infrastructure, particularly our water and wastewater systems. So this is a really, really, really important program that we need to support. We support the bill. We also are pleased with the A5s, particularly Section 3 in lines 16 through 21 that eliminates the 10-foot issue. I understand that you were going to have a conversation about what number it should be, but for me, it's $300,000 to $400,000 more for this program if we increase or remove the 10-foot limit. The way it works, a couple of things. One, the permits are $5 a piece, and as you have heard, they are transferable. The only reason you need them is if you're on the water. This is separate from the inspection program. There are two different kinds of programs. When we took our canoe back to Wyoming, we had to buy a permit all along the way. And so it is not an unusual thing for people to do who are coming from out of state to buy the permit. The inspection is a separate issue. And again, those things are happening now. So I don't want to take a lot of your time except to say that it's just really important that we have the AIS program, that we have the permits, that we create as much funding as possible in a fair manner to make sure that our public infrastructure is supported and protected. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about this.
Thanks, Peggy. Any questions? Okay,
thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2321. Before we go into our information session, colleagues, we have one item up for a work session. So I'm going to open our work session on House Bill 2968A. And, Senator Roblin, would you make a motion, and then we can
discuss. Do we want to hear about it first?
No, do the motion, then put it on the table.
Chair Dembro, I move House Bill 2968A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Roblin has moved House Bill 2968A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This was a bill we heard last week, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Beth, remind us what this does.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the bill that would require DEQ to study and propose legislation that would create a pilot program for voluntary action by property owners to remediate or remove hazardous wastes from their property that would then remove state and federal liability for the property owner.
Okay. Any discussion of the bill, colleagues? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. Anyone want to carry this bill?
I'll do it if you want.
Okay. Senator Brzozinski will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2968 and open our informational meeting. So Richard and Lynn, would you come on up? Colleagues, this is an update on Cleaner Air Oregon, a chance for us to hear what's been going on since we last looked at this program, which I can't remember when it was, September or sometime. We heard a report on plans. So whoever wants to begin.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman, the director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality.
And I'm Lynn Saxton, the director of the Oregon Health Authority.
And I, Chair Dembro, I'm going to kick things off. And I wasn't here, I don't believe, when you last had an update, so I can't speak to that history. But the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Health Authority have been busy over the last over a year working on this issue. And this is a program that is being developed to address a gap in our current system for protecting people and communities from industrial air toxics. It's important to us and to the public to note that this program is based in science, and while DEQ has the lead role here as a regulatory matter, Director Saxton's here with me today because this is very much about science and the role of public health in this program. I do want to just acknowledge before we get into the presentation that industrial air toxics are only part of the issues that we're grappling with in terms of air toxics in our communities. We have longstanding issues regarding wood smoke. In fact, I was recently reviewing a YouTube video of a presentation that was done by a prior DEQ director about 20 years ago on the issue of wood smoke. It's been an issue for 20, 30 years now. And we're also more recently dealing with the air quality issue of diesel emissions from older engines. So this work on industrial air toxics is an important part of that picture. It's the part dealing with very localized impacts of emissions from particular companies.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I'd like to just outline the Health Authority's work on Cleaner Air Oregon and set the health context, if you will. Industrial use of metals, chemicals, and other materials in manufacturing processes can result in release of toxic air pollutants that increase the level of risk to people's health. And this effort began with such a circumstance that occurred and proximate to a daycare center. And we were able to use our authority to resolve that matter successfully. But it introduced the notion that there are gaps in the regulatory framework. We also know that poverty is the single greatest threat to Oregonians' health, and we'll discuss this more, but it's critical to underscore that this initiative is about striking the right balance between the level of risk to people living near industrial facilities and ensuring an air toxics permitting program that is both practicable for industry and aligns with health. We aim to achieve this balance through the rulemaking process, informed by science, and I want to underscore informed by science, and in the best Oregon tradition, an engaged discussion about trade-offs. We continue to welcome a robust conversation about our work with the many stakeholders engaged in this effort. This slide, I think, does a good job of summarizing the authority that DEQ and OHA have been operating under for the last year and a half in response to information about possible health risks. DEQ has the authority to take action when there is, quote, a substantial and imminent threat to the health of persons, and OHA where there is an imminent threat from a chemical release or toxic agent that poses a high probability of a large number of serious or long-term disabilities.
So I want to speak to the issue of why do we need this program? Why aren't our existing programs sufficient to protect public health? We have, under both federal statute and state statute, some authorities to deal with industrial air toxics. However, both at the federal level and the state level, those programs are focused primarily on the ambient air quality effects of industry, so area-wide, community-wide effects. The gap exists primarily because of the very localized, at the fence, what we sometimes call it the fence line impacts of air emissions from a particular facility. The programs that we have right now don't focus on those very localized impacts. And we've seen this gap illustrated across the state in communities where we've had community concerns about air toxics. Perhaps the best known examples of that are the Bullseye facility, the glass manufacturer in the city of Portland. But other situations exist around the state. Ameritize, a railroad tie manufacturer in the Dalles, is another example of an industrial facility where we have been working with that company to reduce their emissions of air toxics in response to concerns from folks living and working in the immediate vicinity of that facility. There are other examples. In Portland, Precision Cast Parts is an example where, again, we had some information that there were health concerns from the immediate impacts from industrial air toxics in that community. Again, the company took voluntary steps to install emissions controls and reduce its emissions in response to those concerns. This is work that DEQ and the health authority are doing every day as part of our regular work. What we don't have, though, is a framework that gives predictability to the business community and to the residents in our communities living near these facilities about what the rules and expectations are. And that has led to a lot of fear on the part of businesses and communities alike about what we do in the state of Oregon to protect from industrial air toxics. So what will this program do? First of all, one element of the program is already underway. We requested emissions inventory data from all air permit holders in the state of Oregon last fall. And those data, some of that data has come in already. More of it will come in September of this year. But those data are allowing us to have a more comprehensive and more accurate picture of what emissions are currently occurring than we have ever had before in the state of Oregon. Under this program, that regular reporting will continue in some form, allowing us to track what's going on in terms of industrial air emissions and to be able to inform our communities about what the risks are and are not. But the main thing that this program will do is to provide a predictable and science-based framework to control industrial air toxics, and one that is health-based in that it will focus on the areas and facilities that pose the highest risk to human health first. So what have we been doing so far just process-wise? Well, first of all, about a year ago, there was an extensive effort to learn from other states that have similar programs to regulate industrial air toxics. There are approximately 30 such programs in other states across the nation, and we've gone through a technical in-depth review of many of those programs in putting together the early design work that's been done on the proposed program here in Oregon. Also, there were a series of forums that were held across the state to gather input from businesses and communities before we even began a Rules Advisory Committee. And then finally, we have a Rules Advisory Committee made up of broad representation from both the business communities as well as community advocates and representatives. Representatives of disproportionately affected communities as well, that has been meeting since November of 2016 to help us put together the framework for this program. We're currently at a stage where, based on that work, we have released a draft framework. This is a very high-level architecture, if you will, for the program. It doesn't contain any of the details and also doesn't really contain decisions on some of the key policy questions for this program. It's intended as a document to help frame what those key policy questions are and help the Rules Advisory Committee and others provide input on those key policy questions. We, in terms of next steps in the process, I want to talk a little bit about where we are right now. So, as I said, we've had the emissions inventory that went out last fall. We are starting to analyze the emissions inventory data right now, and we had scheduled a release of draft rules for the latter part of this month, but after considering input from a number of sources, including from several legislators, we are going to postpone slightly the release of those draft rules so that we can complete at least an initial analysis of the emissions inventory data and talk intelligently and with some knowledge about what the health risks are that are out there so that we can put the concepts in an appropriate factual frame for discussion as we start to make policy decisions. We felt it was a little premature to get the draft rules out at this stage. We do expect that we'll have draft rules in a draft fiscal impact statement out sometime this summer, and then go into a public comment period this fall and early winter, leading to some key decisions and adoption of a program in 2018, spring of 2018. So I've talked a little bit about what the framework is already. It's, again, a way to focus on key policy questions and also allows comparison with programs in other states. And it is really a starting point for discussion. The Rules Advisory Committee will meet again in June to talk some more about the framework and some of the key policy decisions. So what's in this framework? I want to talk about the main elements. The first question here is applicability of the program. At a most basic level, is this program going to apply to existing industrial facilities as well as new ones? The state of Washington to our north has a program that applies to new and modified facilities but doesn't apply to existing existing facilities. To our south in California, they address both existing and new facilities. So that's a first basic question, is just new and existing, and then what types of facilities also. A second question is what types of pollutants and at what concentration levels. The emissions inventory request that we sent out this past fall, asked for information on over 600 different pollutants. That doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to regulate for all 600 pollutants. Again, the purpose of the emissions inventory is to assess risk. We will then make decisions about what pollutants to regulate for. A third element is cumulative risk in a number of different senses. One, we can have multiple emissions from a particular facility. We can have multiple facilities in a community that are emitting air toxics. And finally, we can also have air toxics that are emitted from non-industrial sources. And so figuring out whether that's considered in any way in this program is another element of the program. Risk thresholds. This is an element of the program where we really look to our sister agency, the health authority, to advise us about what's the best science on risk levels that we should regulate to in this program. And then finally, I just want to touch on implementation. Just in terms of expectations around this program, it is very important to be transparent about the fact we are not going to regulate hundreds of facilities through this program, certainly not in any short time frame. In California, it is a very small percentage of the industrial facilities that actually go through a full-blown permitting program. At the highest risk levels, where we do detailed modeling and perhaps even air monitoring to look at air emissions from a particular facility, we are looking at substantial resources, both on the part of the company involved and on the part of the state, to review that work. And as a matter of practical reality, we are going to have to focus on the facilities and areas of highest health risk first. And that is going to be a relatively small number of facilities, necessarily. Okay. So I've talked about some of the key policy considerations already in talking about the elements of the framework. A couple of other things to just note here at the end. One thing that is still very much in play is we work with the Rules Advisory Committee, the public, and the legislature on this, is what are the consequences when we go over particular thresholds. At this point, we have not proposed that if a company goes over a particular threshold that it would necessarily mean that they would have to shut down. That is a question still to be decided. As you saw from the earlier slide that Director Saxton presented, we do have authority right now to shut down facilities, but only in an instance where there is an imminent and substantial threat to public health. That may continue to be the trigger for when we would actually go in and say to somebody, you have to curtail production. Other steps that we would take short of that would be less costly steps that companies can take by substituting materials, by installing emissions controls, by doing things like increasing the height of a stack. There are all sorts of ways that companies can reduce the exposure of neighbors to industrial air toxics. So those are all still very much in play in terms of the what if part of this. The second to last bullet here, place matters. In looking at risk, one side of the risk equation is emissions from a particular facility. The other side is what is around that facility? Is there a school? Is there a daycare center? Is there a home? Is there nothing for half a mile? So place matters. We are looking at facilities in the context of the communities that they sit within. And there is a land use component to this. And one of the things that is also still under some discussion is, in addition to looking at controls within a facility for emissions, should we also be thinking about being more careful about what we site around some of these facilities? That's another thing that could continue to develop as we work on this program. And then finally, we recognize that there may be some variation around the state in terms of priorities in different regions, and we are also considering how to incorporate that into this program as well. Okay, in terms of implementation and next steps, we will continue to work on fleshing out the policy aspects of this proposal. We will continue to work on analyzing the emissions inventory data that we're receiving. And we will be coming to the legislature in the short session in 2018 for the legislature to sign off on the funding mechanism for this program. The legislature has provided some general fund support for this program, but we will need fees to support this program as well. We have a small fee, one-time fee assessment in before this legislative assembly right now, but there will be a permanent a request for a permanent fee structure in early 18. At that time, we expect to be able to tell you all exactly what we are proposing in terms of this program, in terms of how many facilities it might affect, what are the risk levels that we're looking at, and as a practical matter, how quickly can we roll this program out? How might it be phased as well? Okay, and as I said, we've got a proposal before this Legislative Assembly on a one-time assessment to continue the program development work for the 17-18 fiscal year, but then we'll be back in the 2018 session for the permanent proposal. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Director Saxton.
Thank you, Director Whitman. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, this is, I think, a helpful graphic on the path we're on. The first goal, obviously, is to be protective of public health. When this program is in place, we'll be better able to assure Oregonians industrial air toxics are being appropriately controlled to protect their health. As I mentioned, we know the biggest single threat to health is poverty. This initiative is about striking that balance between ensuring people living near industrial facilities are not exposed to an undue burden of chemical risk, especially vulnerable populations, and ensuring an air toxics permitting program that's practicable for industry and aligns with health. We're critical to our concept from the beginning is that this work is grounded in science and that we strike the right balance by ensuring our actions and rules are grounded in solid science and data, and we expect there to be some robust discussions as we move forward. But we welcome those discussions, and we'll bring our best work forward in that setting. And finally, having some level of predictability is critical to all the stakeholders in this process. Using a science-based approach will lead to a consistent and transparent process for addressing the risk from industrial emissions of air toxics while providing predictability to businesses and the communities they are part of throughout Oregon. And I think with that, we are more than happy to answer questions from the committee.
Colleagues. Yes, Senator Rubin.
Yeah, so I really hope, and I'm pleased to hear the fact, because I also encourage the governor of this to slow down the process right now, because we have data coming in and we're going to have rules coming out before the data gets in. Doesn't make a lot of sense right now for me, and I think we do have to take this carefully. Director Whitman and I have had conversations about our land use planning says here's an industrial area, we put everybody there, and then all of a sudden we put everybody there, and now we measure what they're producing, and it's not what individuals produce, it's the whole thing, and so we have created part of that problem. And that land use thing has also basically put housing in certain places at cheaper costs than other places, and that creates this whole situation. And I'm pleased that you're keeping in mind that the number one issue for health is poverty, because for me in rural areas, that's been a really big issue with regard to we're fairly poor out in those places. We used to have pretty good jobs, and a lot of them have gone away for a lot of other kind of environmental, and I don't want to see the same thing happen and make it even poorer for some of these people if all the jobs go away. I guess the part that I hope we, as we're going through this process, acknowledge is that the federal government has had air quality standards. We've had air quality standards for almost every industrial plant we've had. And they've complied, and a lot of companies have put a lot of money into it as those compliances have changed. And I would hope that people understand that they're doing the things we've asked them to do, and we may have new science that tells us new things, but they were always doing, many of them were doing the right things. There have been instances where they didn't, but the vast majority of these companies that are hiring our people and paying wages intended to do the right thing. And all of a sudden, we changed the standard on them. We should not say that they were horrible or whatever. And I worry that we get into a situation when we start a new program that say, well, why didn't they always know this? And why didn't we always XYZ? For me, that's an important part of the process, and I would hope we'd have conversations about that as we move forward.
Yes, Richard.
If I might, Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I appreciate your remarks, Senator, and completely agree with you. I want to make the point that even in the case of many of the better publicized instances around air toxics that we've had in the past year, in almost every case, the companies involved have voluntarily taken steps to reduce their emissions of air toxics. Even where we don't have a specific standard that tells them they absolutely have to reduce, they have been willing to spend significant amounts of money to reduce air toxics. So again, this is part of the work that we do on a routine basis, is look for situations where there may be a health issue out there, and then work with the company on a cooperative, voluntary basis to address the potential health risk. We're not necessarily in a strict regulatory mode here. We are working cooperatively with the companies. And even once we have this program in place so that we have some more predictability, I think in the vast majority of cases, that's how things will work and how things should work going forward.
I'll just piggyback on that, because Richard, you had mentioned, I think it was you, well, one of you mentioned a good neighbor agreement.
Yeah.
That can also be a component here. We have seen companies enter into good neighbor agreements with their neighborhood associations, and I would think that any part of a program like this would be, some aspect of it would be to encourage that kind of interaction.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. I think that's very likely, particularly where we have companies that have emissions that are of concern. They've done everything they can to reduce emissions, and there are still some concerns out there. They may not be the sort of concerns where it warrants curtailing their production, and those cases are prime for an agreement between the company and the community that sets out expectations and a plan for addressing those issues over the long term.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, having grown up in small communities that had pulp mills and stuff, you know, I got a college education, I got out of poverty and other kind of stuff because I had those opportunities, and the people who gave me opportunities were oftentimes the mills. Yeah. You know, I remember as a worker at the mill, we had, you know, pulp mill. When they'd open the digesters, there would be this gas released. One place downwind, I always felt bad for them. In the mill itself, some of it was heavier than air, and the issue was, this isn't poison gas, but you can't breathe when you're in it, so hold your breath. Don't hit the ground, because it's a lot heavier than air. That's going to help you. You know, we had chlorine lines all around, chlorine gas from time to time, burning people's lungs, and learned to hold people up so it pours out of them. Things have changed a lot. We're getting a lot better at those kinds of things. All of the roads in my community in Port Angeles, to make the gravel less dust, they took the liquor out of the pulp mills and they sprayed it on all the roads. And we played behind the sprayers when we were kids playing around. They found out that wasn't a really good thing to be around at the time, so then they dumped it in the bay. And then they decided to clean up the bay, and all those fish came back. So it's been an amazing process to watch the kinds of things that I've done throughout my life. Mm-hmm. I think in every case, they tried to do the right things with the information they had at the time.
Yep.
And I don't hold them responsible for exposing me to different things. I recognize that the best science is available, and the jobs that they provided and the families that they helped raise were important. As we get better science and know more, I think it'll be... And I hope this program is helpful with that and getting to people to know and understand stuff. And being in a family that has a lot of allergies in my family, a lot of people think milk's really good. It was not really great for my kid. So, you know, there's a lot of things out there and a lot of toxics that for individuals have a much bigger hazard. And knowledge is really helpful.
Yeah.
So if you have a family and there are certain things that are out there, it may be really bad for one of your kids, and you know you can't live there. Other people, it's not going to have the same kinds of effects. And I hope we continue to have real conversations about making sure that we have the best we can do at prices that are affordable and don't close down places. Because I've watched when mills and other things have been closed down, and communities who were reasonably healthy became much less healthy with the other kinds of things that happens with poverty. So I'm happy to hear what you're saying.
Thank you.
Yeah, just following up on that, I attribute all my mental shortfalls to my summer working in a plastics factory.
Exactly.
it has stayed with me. One of the biggest challenges that we face, and I think that Cleaner Air Oregon faces, is this notion of looking at things in terms of airsheds and cumulative effects, right? And yet it's extremely important that we think in those terms. You know, we've seen that methodology somewhat being used in terms of non-attainment areas with respect to wood smoke and, you know, some other air quality issues where businesses that may not in and of themselves be, you know, creating the problem, mm-hmm. still are affected by the problem. And, you know, where each entity may be hitting their thresholds, but cumulatively it becomes, you know, serious, serious health risk. And so how do you talk to companies about that, you know, where, you know, they feel like, well, we're, you know, we're under our limits, and yet we've got to take action.
So, Chair Dembrough, this is still very much an issue that is live in front of the Rules Advisory Committee and the agencies, is how to deal with what are actually much greater health threats to some of our communities, diesel emissions from various types of older engines in particular, and then wood smoke also, and particularly often in our rural communities. And so what do you've got an existing health burden or pollution burden out there that a community is facing. And the question is, if you're looking at an individual factory, they may be responsible for a very small sliver of that overall pollution burden. But what do you say to them if they if they're an existing company? Do they get to continue? What if they want to expand? What do you do then? What if a new company is coming into a community like that and you've got enormous poverty issues? How do you sort all those things out? We don't have definitive answers for that yet. I think there's been some sentiment on the Rules Advisory Committee that it's not fair to make the companies in those situations bear the burden, if you will, of all those other sources. On the other hand, looking at it from the community perspective, if you are already in a situation where you have serious health concerns, should you entertain any action that's going to make it worse? The one thought that I'll give you for right now is, again, looking to our south in California, they do, at least for new facilities and for new roads or anything that's going to be new to the community, they do look at the existing context that new thing is going into. It's one thing to say it's unfair for an existing company, but for this is where a new company or a new highway is the best example that's coming into a community. Maybe in those circumstances where you do, it's a open book, you do have more opportunity to consider that existing background in terms of where things get placed. I don't know if that's where this program will go, sort of distinguishing between new and existing, but that might be one way to address the fairness issue while also recognizing the community concerns.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Lynn, did you want to
say? Nothing to add. I think one of the things I think we're pleased about the work so far is that we're able to have these conversations at a fairly detailed level with the stakeholders around the table, with people being candid and frank and to be blunt, sometimes even being a little upset. But I think we've kept our eye on, which the experience we had a year ago requires us to do, we've kept our eye on the science, we've kept our eye on the data. We've kept our eye on the health requirements of the community, and we'll continue to do that.
Okay, well, thank you both for coming today and sharing.
Appreciate it.
So this, I realize it's a work in progress, and I assume this topic will be on our September Ledge Days hearings for an update.
We'd be happy to report.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close our informational hearing, and that that finishes our work for the day. I will announce that we're not going to be meeting on Thursday. Okay, we're scheduled to meet on Thursday. We actually have a presentation on hydraulic fracturing on Thursday, but because the Dogami agency is having their bill, their budget heard at the same time, they absolutely have to be in the room. So
it'll be good for them to be.
So we'll put that off till next week. So with that, we are adjourned.